Hey, thanks for listening to the Bellevue Christian Church podcast. We're a church in Bellevue, Pennsylvania, where ordinary people are learning to live everyday life like Jesus. We believe that one way to learn that life is by engaging with an ancient but active collection of books called the Bible every single week. If this teaching leaves you with a question about the content or a story of what God is doing in your life, please send a message to hello@bellevuechristian.church because we'd love to hear from you.
There's a Christian author, writer named Brent McCracken, and he wrote a book called Uncomfortable a few years back. And he's just writing about what it looks like to be the church, and especially for my generation, what it looks like to be involved in the church. And he opens the book by asking readers to think about their dream church, as vividly as they can. And I found that to be a helpful exercise when I came across it. And I want to do the same with us this morning. I know all of you are thinking, but Austin, this is my dream church. It's going to be hard to imagine something else. Just humor me for a second, guys. Just imagine your dream church, because if I'm honest, this isn't always mine. So let's talk about this. So think about the building. What's the building like in your dream church? Is it an old Gothic-style cathedral or something that feels new and modern? Something that feels more like a coffee shop than a typical church building? What's the worship like? Is it theologically rich hymns, or is it closer to something you might hear on Caleb? Does it include reciting things like the creeds and the Lord's Prayer, or does it mostly just stick to music when it comes to worship? Would it have like a lot of acoustic sets, or would it include our drums, or would it be more organ if it was your preference? What's the preaching like? It's every week expository. Some of you are like, I don't even know what that is. Verse-by-verse preaching. Or is it more in line with topical preaching on things like money or marriage or work most of the time? Does the speaker sound more like a professor or a TED Talk speaker or an old-fashioned revival preacher? Does the preaching speak to the issues of the day? Or does they mostly keep quiet about a lot of that, trying to just kind of not say anything about what's going on in the world? Which Bible translation do they preach from? In your dream church, what is the kids and youth programs like? Is it broken down by age division, or do all the kids sit with their families for the entirety of the service? Do they play games, you know, and have some fun, or do they stick to the serious stuff of theology? What's the outreach like? Do we support missionaries and unreached people groups around the globe, or do we stick to partnering with hyper-local nonprofits, or some mix of the two? Are we primarily involved in justice work or in evangelism, or both? Do we offer all kinds of programs in our church for people to meet every conceivable need, or is it mostly, do we keep things relatively simple? And perhaps the most important question, what about the coffee? Is there coffee at all? Right now, we don't have any. So, but is it the least expensive cup of Folgers that we can make, or is it craft coffee from someplace like Commonplace? We're putting together budgets right now, and I'm starting to think about that. Is there a barista ready to make drinks on demand with beautiful latte art, or is it a coffee self-serve out of a craft, possibly from the 80s? It's hard to know. Even if you're struggling to imagine your dream church, all of us have a vision in our hearts, sitting in the back of our minds, at the bottom of our hearts, about what our dream church would be like. Again, even me. We have these expectations, these visions of how we think our church should be, the ideal church. Maybe you've never articulated it, or you couldn't even articulate it, but it shows up all the time in those moments where you find yourself disappointed with your church. Whenever you find yourself disappointed with your church, what disappointment reveals is a gap between our dream church that's in our heads, or our hearts, and our actual church, the one that we're sitting in right now. Those moments of disappointment reveal the gap between our expectations of how we want our church to be and the reality of how our church actually is. It's one of the reasons why for a long time when I would meet somebody new in our church, I would often say to them, hey, welcome to our church, just so you know, we're going to disappoint you. Julie told me to stop saying that. So she said it wasn't having the right effect. I think she's right. And here's the thing, though. When our church inevitably disappoints you, disappoints one of the expectations that's grounded in your vision of your dream church, we're faced with a decision. You're faced with the decision, do you stay? Do you stay at a church that doesn't live up to all of your wildest expectations? Or do you leave and go look for one that maybe could be a little bit closer? This morning, we want to consider two different mindsets that lead to two different answers to that question, and how we can shift from one mindset to the other as we continue with our series, really finishing out in the final week of our series, Churches That Last. In this series is based out of the fact that, as you saw in that video before the sermon, our church has been around since 1896. Many churches since 1896 have closed their doors for a variety of different reasons, but somehow our church has stayed the course. It's been here for almost 125 years this fall, and the hope is that we could be at the intersection, a generation that's at the intersection of what's going to be another 125 years of our church. If we can figure out why our church has lasted this long thus far, the hope is that maybe we can last another 125 years as well. And so I had a list of like 7 reasons why I think our church has lasted. I got it down to 3 because I love you, and we're on the 3rd reason now. And so there's 3 reasons that when you look at the history of our church, when you look at the scriptures, why churches last, 3 things. First one we talked about is about commission over constructs. In other words, we're about the why before we're about the how. The how of church changes, the why stays the same. The other thing that Isaac talked about last week is that the convictions stay the same as well. They act as our guardrail. They're rooted in the scriptures. Those don't change. The scriptures is still true, trustworthy, and authoritative in our church. But when churches begin to compromise on that, usually what you find is that they actually think you think you're being relevant, you actually end up fading to irrelevant slowly. And then finally, this week what we're going to talk about is the difference between commitment and consumerism. And when you look at churches that last, this is the one that ultimately makes the difference as well. You need all 3 of these. But the thing is, you could have the most biblical convictions imaginable, all carefully listed out in a doctrine statement somewhere. You could be completely committed to the Great Commission and constantly shifting the how of church to fulfill the why. But if you don't have people who are committed to your church, and you just have consumers who are ready to move on at the smallest thing that they don't like, you won't have a church that lasts. But when you look at why our church has lasted 125 years, you see that it's full of people who are committed. And that's what I want to talk about today. If you have a Bible, open up to Matthew chapter 16, verse 24, just one verse. Matthew chapter 16, verse 24. I'll be reading from the Christian Standard Bible today. We didn't mean to do this, but our key passage every week has been from Matthew. Last week, Isaac preached from Matthew chapter 5 about how the church is to be salt and light. He talked about convictions. 2 weeks ago, I talked about Matthew chapter 28 and about what it means to fulfill the Great Commission. In the opening week, we also talked from Matthew chapter 16, verses 13 through 20, where Jesus talks about how he's going to build his church and how the gates of hell will not even stand against it. And this week, we're going to be looking at, I just thought we'd continue the trend with Matthew chapter 16, verse 24. So it's a few verses after Jesus spoke to Peter about building the church. Again, you might remember that Jesus had this conversation with Peter. He's like, hey, Peter, who do people say that I am? And they're saying all these different people. And then Peter's like, I think you're the Messiah. And Jesus is like, you got it. You're awesome. You are Peter, and then he says this amazing thing about him. He's like, on this rock, I'm going to build my church. Gates of hell aren't going to stand against it. You are going to have the keys to the kingdom, the authority to bind and loose, all this good stuff, really pumping up Peter. And then immediately after that, in the next few verses, Jesus says something that he has not yet said for about 2/3 of the Gospel of Matthew. And he begins to talk about how when they get to Jerusalem, he's going to suffer and die. Which if you're following a Messiah who's going to suffer and die, you're probably following the wrong Messiah, is what Peter begins to think. He's like, look, I thought Messiahs were supposed to be victors. I thought they were supposed to go and save us from oppression and all these different things. And you're saying you're going to suffer and die. And so Peter pulls Jesus aside and he says to him, hey, Jesus, you know, let me just clear things up. You know, I think you might have gotten the Messiah thing a little bit wrong. You're going about this wrong. Suffer and die is really not what's supposed to happen when you get to Jerusalem. Let's correct course a little bit. And at this point, Jesus completely switches the way he talks to Peter. In Matthew chapter 16, verses 13 through 20, he says, man, you're the rock on which I'm going to build the church. But by verse 24, when Peter's pulling him aside and trying to correct him, he says to him, you are ultimately, get behind me, Satan. He moves from calling him the rock that he's going to build the church on to calling him Satan in about 6-7 verses. And suddenly Peter is taken aback and Jesus begins to go into explaining again what's going to happen and what it looks like to follow him. And it's in this verse in chapter 16, verse 24, where he begins to explain what is probably the most famous line about what it means to be a disciple. And it's right on the heels of when he talks about building his church. So let's read this. Matthew chapter 16, verse 24. It says, then Jesus said to his disciples, in other words, people who are following him, learning from him. He says, if anybody wants to follow after me, let him deny himself. Everybody say deny himself. take up his cross. Everybody say, take up his cross. And follow me. Everybody say, follow me. So again, Jesus had just said to Peter that he's in the process of building the church. Go back a few verses. That's what he says. And as a reminder, the church isn't a building. He's not Jesus and saying, I'm going to go build some church buildings. Although the church often meets in a building, he says, I'm building a people who are committed to me, around, built around the confession that Jesus is Lord. And now this is the kind of people that they are. He's in this line now. He's beginning to explain the kind of people who are going to fill the church, the kind of people who are going to form the church that he is building, people who confess that he is the Messiah and then who go a step further, not just saying Jesus is Lord, but who follow after him, saying, denying themselves, taking up their cross and following him. And it's in this description of what the people are like who fill his church that you see the polar opposite of what we tend to elevate in our cultural moment. Let me just put it on a chart for us of how Jesus begins to show us something completely different than what we see now when it comes to what we elevate. For Jesus says when he's building his church, the first mark of somebody that he's building his church with is they're going to be self-denying. They're going to be self-denying. He says they're going to deny themselves. In other words, instead of doing whatever feels right or what you want most, that you're committed to putting yourself to death. In the words of Paul, it doesn't mean that you're not dignified or made in the image of God. He's just saying that your fleshly, your selfish desires saying no to the self and its preferences or desires. On the other hand, we live in a cultural moment that says the exact opposite. If you look up the opposite of deny, the opposite of that word is affirm. And we live in a cultural moment that is self-affirming, that the main statement of our cultural moment is to be true to yourself. We live in a moment where the greatest sin, if there is any sin in our cultural moment, it is to not be true to yourself. And for many people, that's the worst thing that you could possibly be, is not true to yourself, whatever that means. So instead of denying the self, you need to be true to yourself, which means in the words of Princess Elsa, you need to let it go. No matter what it is, you need to say yes to self and its preferences and desires, even if it makes your entire kingdom covered in ice. Very specific humor. My son loves Frozen. So, second thing, self-denying, cross-bearing, cross-bearing. When it comes to following Jesus and the kinds of persons that he's going to fill the church with, they're self-denying and they're cross-bearing. The cross is a symbol of pain. When we get to the end of the Gospel of Matthew, you see Jesus dies on a cross through crucifixion. It's terrible. And Jesus is saying that following him is going to involve a level of pain, persecution, suffering, and struggle, and sometimes literal death in order to stay true to him. It won't always be easy, he's saying. It's going to often be difficult. It's going to be so difficult at times that you feel like you're going to need to give up, but he says you got to bear your cross. You got to bear your cross. That's the opposite of what we elevate in our cultural moment, which is cross avoiding, unless you're doing CrossFit in which pain is gain. But otherwise, you want to avoid pain at all costs. You want to avoid pain at all costs. We live in a society that's designed to minimize pain, maximize pleasure. If a particular path is difficult or painful, you got to leave that path and you got to go find a new one. If a relationship, you know, becomes difficult at any, you should probably just abandon that friend and go find a new friend. Pain is always bad, but pleasure is always good. And so we see again these polar opposites between what Jesus is saying and what's elevated in our cultural moment. And then again, the last most obvious piece of what the kind of person that he's filling the church with will demonstrate is they'll be Jesus following. He says they're self-denying, cross-bearing, and Jesus-following. The church is full of people who are seeking to model their lives after Jesus, following him wherever he leads, as they deny themselves, take up their cross, even when their hearts say otherwise. As we say as a church, they're ordinary people learning to live everyday life like Jesus, which again is the opposite of what we say in our culture right now. We're a heart-following culture. You've probably heard it at some point. Maybe somebody gave you this advice to follow your heart. Follow your heart. If it feels right, do it. You know what's best for you. No one else does, including Jesus. You do you. And as you can imagine, these two different mindsets, these two different ways of being in the world, lead to two different kinds of people. On the one hand, you get people who are what you might call the committed, people who are committed to Jesus through thick and thin. On the other hand, you get the consumer, people who will follow him when it's convenient and lines up with their preferences. Again, if you follow the self-denying, cross-bearing, Jesus-following way, you'll end up committed. If you follow the self-affirming, cross-avoiding, heart-following way, you'll end up more like a consumer. And if you pay attention to Jesus and you walk through him in the Gospels, what you find is that they might not have used the word consumer at the time, but there were plenty of consumers who were following Jesus. When things got hard, they were like, you know what, maybe we're going to go back to our homes. You know, when Jesus at one point in the Gospel of John says, hey guys, we're going to eat my flesh soon. They're like, we're out, okay? It just got weird, and we're done here. And they move on. And then the other disciples are thinking about it too, but they say, look, where else are we going to go? They stay committed even when things were strange and they weren't sure how to process it. Even if in the end, even they abandon at some point. Elton Trueblood, one of my favorite writers, writing in 1951, summarized just this difference of mindset. He says, herein is the significance of the cryptic, follow me. He was not advising people to go to church or even to attend a synagogue. He would go on to say again that church going is part of this, but making a point here. He was instead asking for recruits in a company of danger. He was not asking primarily just for belief, in other words, people to assent to something with their heads, but for commitment with consequence involvement. There's a lot more that we could say about Matthew chapter 16, verse 24. And we're going to come back in a minute and talk more about it. But again, if we follow the way of Jesus as described here, it leads to committed people. The opposite, the way of the world, leads to consumers. One who will follow Jesus no matter what the cost, and the other who will split the moment it's difficult. But this is a series called Churches That Last. What does this have to do with churches that last? After a decade of doing ministry, one of the things that I've seen over and over in my life is that many of us are all about being committed to Jesus. But when it comes to church involvement, we often look more like the consumer than the committed. We might say in our hearts, look, yes, Jesus, I'm going to deny myself. I'm going to take up my cross. I'm going to follow you through thick and thin. I'll go through persecution for you. I'll go to jail for you. I'll resist pizza late at night because I want to resist my fleshly desires. I'm going to deny myself, take up my cross, and follow you, Lord. But the moment that my church sings a song that I don't like, the moment that the pastor says something that offends me, the moment that their t-shirt is not cool enough for me, I'm going to go find a new church with cooler t-shirts, a building that fits my vibe, and songs that I can rock out to. And then I'm going to deny myself. I'm going to follow you. I'm going to take up my cross. That's that. But, you know, again, as soon as this moment comes up where there's this awkward moment with church, or this moment where things are out of touch with you, or this moment of disconnect, is suddenly what can happen is that we shift from that committed mindset to that consumer. And we say, Jesus, look, I'm all about denying myself, taking up my cross, and following you, except when the church doesn't fit my preferences. To quote Brett McCracken, whose exercise we used at the beginning, he says this, describing this difference. He says, consumerism is about unlimited choice and unlimited speed. We choose exactly what we want, take only what we want from it, move on. The mindset has infiltrated the way we approach church. In other words, he's saying that what we do at Target has now come to church with us as a thing that we can design according to our checklist of preferences. And if a church stops catering to our desires or makes us uncomfortable, we move on. There are dozens of other options in town. Consumerism is chronic dissatisfaction. We're always on the quest for more and better, hoping for new heights of satisfaction. The dream church is always a potential out there. The grass is always greener at the trendy new church in town. But how do we get here? How do we get to the point where this mindset has gotten into all of our minds and hearts without us even thinking about it? I think there's at least three big kind of societal changes that I've seen over the past 500 years. Again, yes, we're going to do 500 years of history real quick, that have contributed to the culture of consumerism in the church. Things that aren't your fault, but they're now our responsibility once we're aware to break out of them. Consider the first one. It's the rise of options. This is a picture of Martin Luther up here in just a second. But if you think back to the first century, we'll get to Martin Luther in a minute, there weren't options for where you went to church. There was pretty much just like one church in town. So if you think back to when the church started, there was like the church in Corinth, and that was it. There wasn't First Baptist Church of Corinth. There wasn't Journey Church of Corinth. You couldn't read Google reviews or check out websites. It was just like one church with 40 people, 35 of which you didn't really like. And so you had to go to that church, though, because there was really no other option for anywhere else. There wasn't a campus of a mega church in Corinth based out of Ephesus where you could hear Paul's teaching week to week, because we all know he's the best preacher and we want to make sure we could hear him every week, even when he's not in town. And that was pretty much the case until about 500 years ago when this guy showed up, Martin Luther. Nothing against him, but you went to one church in town and everybody, that was pretty much it. But then the church at that point had gone astray and started to believe some things that were out of touch with the scriptures as people were beginning to open the Bible for themselves. And so people like Martin Luther and John Calvin and John Huss rose up to try to lead it back. And they were trying to reform it from the inside, fix up some of that stuff. They weren't planning to leave, but that's what ended up happening. The church wasn't having it. So they ended up being left with no choice. And so they ended up starting their own churches, which were known as Protestants, which has the word protest in it, which because they were protesting one way of being the church for another way of being the church. And this reminds us again that sometimes there are times to leave a church. They found themselves left with no choice at the time because they were finding that the church had gone astray. And after trying to reform it, they had out of conscience had to leave. But it's worth noting, I think it's worth noting here, that not every theological difference is heresy. In other words, a hill worth dying on. Some are, but not every single one. And so, but what happened though is once Luther did this, once Luther was like, hey, look, I'm out, guys. I'm going to tell you all the things that I don't think you guys are doing right. I'm going to go start another church. That then opened the door for a lot of other people to do the same thing. People did that to Luther later. And they're like, hey, look, Luther, we're not feeling this. We're going to do this. I would not suggest, by the way, that you put like 99 reasons why you're leaving our church on our church door. If you do, just let me know. personally, don't leave it on Google. So nonetheless, that's what I feel like he might have done today. But nonetheless, look, it opened the door to eventually have more and more churches popping up as there are more and more differences arising till any town has not just one church, but three, four, a dozen or more different kinds of church. And so that was the first thing. 500 years ago, you have all these options showing up. Now, go to 100 years ago. Something significant was invented that changed the way we think about church, and it was the car. It's particularly the Ford Motor Company made a car that most people could afford for the first time in history. And up until the wide availability of cars, you pretty much had to go to church that was within like a walking distance of your house or like a horse ride. If you ever wonder why does our church only have 6 parking spaces? It's because it was built in 1899 and nobody had cars. They walked here or they rode their horses. I don't know if there was like stables or something, but that's how people got to church back in the day. They had those like big bikes with like one wheel on the front and a tiny little wheel on the back. That's how people got to church. But the car was invented and suddenly you weren't limited to options within walking distance. So because of Luther, you had like 12 options within walking distance. But now because of the car, you have all of the options in all of the towns within 20 miles of your house that you can get to in time on a Sunday morning after getting all of your kids out of bed. And so you have the rise of these all kinds of churches that are, you know, commuter churches that you go to different churches that are further and further away, and which is why even churches today often may have big parking lots. It's one of our constant problems. There's not enough parking at our church. But why, if you built a church today, it has a big parking lot? It's because of the rise of cars. Now, if you go to 30 years ago, the game changed again. I just kind of put this in the rise of cars with the rise of the internet. And we've especially started to feel this recently. Now it doesn't matter if the church is within driving distance. You can just listen to sermons from another church. I do all the time. Or watch services online, just as we offer from anywhere. And so any remaining geographical boundaries to where you go to church, completely gone. Just this morning, anybody that wants to could attend any church almost in the world. Do you realize that you are the first people in history to ever have that option? Be the first people ever who could log on to YouTube right now and find a church probably in any country of the world that you could attend or watch. We have options. The final thing is the rise of authenticity. The rise of authenticity. I've kind of hinted at this with a couple other things. But at some point, human beings began to feel the need to be authentic above everything else. And authenticity is a good thing in some ways. Authenticity means that there's no gap between what you feel on the inside and then the way you kind of are on the outside. But what happened is authenticity became the main thing for everybody all the time. Charles Taylor, a philosopher, says, we entered into a time called the age of authenticity. And what that means is that the most important thing about your church, when you apply authenticity to a church, is that it fits what you already believe and already think. So when you show up at a church, instead of allowing it to change you, you force it to change according to your preferences. That you go to a church that resonates with you and what you already believe, that makes sense to you, that can be an expression of you. So instead of letting go of our preferences, we look for a church that's in line with our preferences, one that allows us to be our authentic selves. Instead of trying to change ourselves, we try to change our churches to fit ourselves, or we just change churches. I'm a little feisty this morning. With these three things combining, the rise of options, the rise of cars and the internet, and the rise of authenticity, what ends up happening is that whether we mean to or not, this is in me as well, you get a consumer culture in the church and we all end up like Goldilocks, which is a terrifying story. I've read it a lot to my children lately. And you go from church to church looking for one that's just right until the bears come back and eat you alive, depending on what version of the story you're reading. I'm not sure where that part of the metaphor fits, but I'll leave that with us. So here's what Mark Sayers says in Disappearing Church, just kind of summarizing this, and he's talking about some of the disappearances. And he says, you see the disappearance of a mode of church engagement characterized by commitment and resilience and sacrifice among many Western believers. In its place, a new mode of the disengaged Christian faith and church interaction is emerging. The new mode is characterized by sporadic engagement, passivity, commitment phobia, and consumerist framework. What I want to say again, this isn't like your thing to repent of. This isn't your fault. It's an inherited mindset that's based out of the culture we're living in. It's like, this is the water we're swimming in. And now it's up to us, when we're aware of it, to figure out what are we going to do about it. The question is, what does it look like to get out of that mindset, the consumer mindset, and into the committed mindset? How do we apply Matthew chapter 16, verse 24 to how we think about church involvement? Last Monday night, 2 weeks ago, for 3 hours, with my friend Zach McClelland, who goes here, we sat up on the stage, and he set up multiple cameras, and we brought in people who have been at our church for 50 years or more and interviewed them. I actually looked through the directory from our 75th anniversary 50 years ago in 1971. And I went through that directory from that year and made a list of everyone who was involved at that time, or at least at some point before then. I interviewed them. I asked them all kinds of questions, including why they've stayed. And we filmed all of it, by the way, so we're going to show you a video at some point soon. But much of what they had to say reflects what Jesus says in this text about denying yourself, taking up your cross, and following Jesus. And it pushes back against the consumer culture of the church now. Can't wait to show you that video. But for now, what I want to say is some things I learned from them and some things I learned as I read the scriptures and just from our text for today about how we can move from consumer to committed. How we can, again, all of us have this mindset in us somewhere. And so what I want us to do is all of us to say, how can we shift from that mindset to a committed mindset? And so I want to give you 3 suggestions, 3 intentional ways that you can shift from consumer to committed. The first thing is this, is make the shift from shuffling to staying. Make the shift from shuffling to staying. Last week, I was with some pastors from all over the country, 100 or so pastors, and I got talked with a lot of them. And one of the things that many of us are calling the season we're in right now as a church, we're calling it the Great Reshuffling. Because at every church, every pastor, one of the things they've said is everybody is reconsidering where they go to church right now. And what I want to say is if that's you, that's okay. Right now is a normal time, I think, where everybody's kind of coming out of the pandemic and starting to say, where do I go? Where do I go now? I haven't really connected in a while. Where do I go to church? And so I know everybody's kind of in that mindset. But at some point, this is what I've been encouraging people, is while you're doing that, at some point, find a place that you say, this is good enough. I'm going to settle in. I'm going to settle in for the long run. Whether that's here or somewhere else. And one of the reasons why staying matters is one of the things that I've seen over my years in ministry is that people who stay in relationships with people the longest, relationships they make in church, what they find is that that accelerates your spiritual growth. And that one of the ways to decelerate your spiritual growth is to constantly go from one set of relationships to another, to another, to another, constantly relearning a new church and a new set of people every single time things get hard. What ends up happening is you can't plant the relational roots that are necessary for growth. Joseph Hellerman, in a book called When the Church Was a Family, writes this. He says, long-term interpersonal relationships are the crucible of genuine progress in the Christian life. People who stay also grow. People who leave don't. By all means, it's okay to shuffle a bit. I think now is like a really normal time in our culture to do that. But eventually, what I encourage you to do is settle in. Think of it like a marriage for a minute. Dating is totally normal in preparation for marriage. But at some point, you need to stop dating, get married. And once you're married, you need to stop acting like you're still on the market, flirting with every new hot church that's in town. All right, let's move on. You can quote me on that. That's the quote for the week. So, second thing, shuffling to staying. Second thing is this, from sporadic to consistent. From sporadic to consistent. I also like to think of us as the hot church that's in town right now, but this is another story for another day. From sporadic to consistent.
From 1993 to 2020, people who said they attended church in the last 7 days went from 45% to 29%. So from about half the country to about a third. Part of that, obviously, is because less and less people are religious in general. The other reason, though, that the data shows is less and less people who are religious, who are considering themselves Christians, feel the need to show up either in person or even online week after week. And so it becomes kind of a hit or miss thing, where church attendance, again, right now I understand the caveat is we're in strange times, so people are attending online, in person, I get that. That's not a judgment call about where we are right now. But in general, what's been often happening is that we'll go if it fits our schedule. We go if we like the series that we're in right now. We go if we're serving on a team. We go if we like who's preaching. We go if something interesting, more interesting doesn't show up or that doesn't come up in that week. In the end, though, part of shifting from consumer to committed is doing what it takes to show up. Recently, Julie and I committed to a weekly date night. Same time, same day every week. It's about 2 hours. But imagine if I wasn't all that committed to it. Imagine if I made this big, like, yeah, I'm committed, you know, I want to do this thing, but I wasn't actually all that committed to it. And, you know, maybe I go for the first date night, and, you know, we have 4 date nights a month. I go for the first one, maybe I go to the third, but for the second one, I'm like, hey, something came up with my friends. You think it would be cool if I just skipped out on this date night? We don't really need to connect that much. So I really need to connect with my friends. So would it be okay if I just did that? Or maybe I said to her, like, man, that Jane Austen movie you want to watch? I don't want to watch that. I want to go watch this documentary about murder. So I'm going to watch it up in my room, and I'm just going to skip out on our date night. Is that okay with you? Is that fine? Is it okay if we don't go out to dinner? Maybe we go have our own separate food somewhere else. What would that do to my marriage? Anybody want to guess? Okay, not good things. But for some reason it's okay with the church. Some reason it's okay to treat the church, the bride of Christ, that way. As something that we hit or miss when it comes to dates, when it comes to meeting here. If you're not in the habit of showing up consistently, what I would encourage you to do, again, whether that's online or in person, now's a weird time, I get that. But what I would say is, what would it take to commit to that habit? All of us have been out of the habit. Even me in the last year when we were just online, I was like, meh. You know, I know the sermon. I preached it. We pre-recorded it. Do I have to watch it? But again, if you're not in the habit of showing up, wherever that is right now, what I would encourage you is to maybe make a commitment in your heart to say, what would it look like to really show up between now and the end of the year? Again, whether that's online, if that's where it is right now, or whether it's in person. Third thing is this. So from shuffling to staying, from sporadic to consistent, from taking to giving. Often the consumer mindset says, what can I get out of this church? That's what the consumer will often ask. But the committed mindset says, what can I give to this church? One wants to be entertained. The other wants to engage. One is primarily concerned with being fed. Again, what does the word consume mean? It means to eat. And so a consumer sees a church primarily as a place where they get fed. Whereas the other person, the person who's giving, the committed, is often seen it as a place where they can feed others, where they can pour out, not just be poured into, although there's room for both. To quote my brother Elton again, he says this. He says, millions are merely backseat Christians, willing to be observers of the performance which the professionals put on, ready to criticize or applaud, but not willing even to consider the possibility of real participation. Often in Christianity, we have a lot of armchair quarterbacking. We stay out of the game, we criticize from the sides. But people who take ownership, people who are committed, throw themselves into the mix, which is so many of you who have done that in this church. That's why I love this church. Shifting from consumer to committed, I encourage you again to find ways not just to take, but to give and to take ownership. Not just through financial giving, although that's one way you can do it, but through serving on teams. That's like through something like Basecamp, where you find out about our teams, or finding ways to care for the needs of others as something comes up in prayer that you hear about. Instead of saying, well, I hope the church meets that need, saying, how can I meet that need? How can I do something about that? In the end, our church is not here to entertain you. We're here to equip you. One thing nearly every pastor of every church hears at some point, maybe once a year, is something like, this church isn't meeting my needs. And almost every time I say, what if that's because you're in a place of Christian maturity now, where God is calling you to meet the needs of others in our church, not just have your needs met? What if God is calling you higher, to not just sit in a group and be poured into, but to lead a group and pour into others. Not just to sit and hear something, but to get involved and participate. And so that there's that give and take, not just take. And so if you want to move from consumer to committed, I suggest intentionally making those three shifts. from shuffling to staying, from sporadic to consistent, from taking to giving. Because in the end, the dream church that all of us are looking for doesn't actually exist. But I've always thought that if you stick it out with a good enough church long enough, there's a chance that you'll see the church become something even better than your dream church. In fact, every great church that I know of started off as a good enough church with great people who committed to that church and committed to seeing God's dream, not just their dream, but God's dream for that church. I want to change our slogan to Bellevue Christian Church, a good enough church. That's really how I feel about this. But to do that, we have to let go of our dream churches. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, writing in the 1940s, says this about Christian community. He says, every human wish dream, in other words, every dream church that's injected into the Christian community is a hindrance to genuine community. It must be banished if genuine community is to survive. He who loves his dream of a community more than the Christian community itself becomes a destroyer of the latter, even though his personal intentions may ever be so honest and earnest and sacrificial. The point here isn't that you shouldn't have ideals for what our church should be. The point is, though, that you don't let those ideals get in the way of the community that God has actually placed in front of you. That's why my mom and dad, when they were the pastors here, they would add members to our church and they gave them a cross. They would say something like, you know, we don't give you a seat, we don't give you many rights, or we don't give you like a benefits package or anything like that, but we give you a cross. It's a reminder that Matthew chapter 16:24 is at the heart of what it means to be involved in the church. To deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. There's an open question here. Like, is there ever a time to leave a church? The answer is, of course, yes, for a variety of reasons. Sometimes if it's drifted away from biblical conviction, sometimes if you've experienced intense pain or toxicity at a church or something like that, or a variety of other reasons, or maybe you just move further away. But my guess is that the reason to leave is not as often as we think. When I was talking to Marilyn Johnstone a few weeks ago, the unofficial church historian of our church, and I was asking her all kinds of questions about our church, one of the things that she said when I asked her why our church has lasted so long is, without hesitation, she said, even when times were bad, people stayed with our church. When times were good, when they were bad, people stayed. As we close, I just want to give you a concrete way to do this, a concrete way to move from consumer to committed. At our church, we practice something called membership. And you might be like, I didn't know that. It's because I haven't added a single one since I started in February of 2020. We got busy with some other stuff. And it's a way, though, membership is a way of taking ownership in our church. And it's a way of saying, this is where I belong. This is my church through thick and thin. It's a decision to plant yourself deeply in a place. It's a decision to close down your other options, to stop dating churches, and to actually get married to one for a while. It's an opportunity to push back, especially with my generation, millennials and Gen Z, to push back against the non-committal narrative of our cultural moment. And again, we haven't added members since I started, but we're ready to do that now. And so we asked just a couple of things. In addition to being 18 years old, there's a couple of things that we asked. We asked that you've confessed Jesus as Lord and Savior. In other words, you have to be a Christian. The second thing is we asked that you've been baptized in water by immersion as a believer. So not just infant baptized, but baptized as a believer. Again, not every church shares that conviction, but that's a church, our conviction that we have. And the third thing is that you've attended this membership class that we're creating now. This is a new requirement, but we're building a class that we believe will set you up to be not just a taker in our church, but to be a giver, somebody who really invests for the long haul in our church. And so that's going to be next Monday at 6 o'clock p.m. So you have this Sunday and next Sunday to sign up. And then the following Sunday, we're actually going to have membership Sunday. But in order to get into that, you have to go through this class first. As we close, I just want to end with, one pastor said that if you really want to make a difference, the way that you can do that is you can find a church and you can stay there for 25 years. It doesn't have to be a perfect church, just a good enough church. My hope is that there are some of you here who do that. My hope is that there are some people sitting here today who are still here at our 150th anniversary 25 years from now, who are telling stories of God's faithfulness over 25 or 50 or 75 years involved in our church. My hope is that there are people that are still here when I'm no longer the pastor. My hope is that there are people still here when we invent some new instrument and add it into the lineup up here. My hope is that there are people still here no matter what our church goes through. My hope is that there are people still here when we switch programs, we try doing something a different way, or we do outreach in one way, or we do it in another way, or our coffee changes. My hope is that there are still people still here for the long run. Again, there are healthy reasons to leave a church. But when you look at churches throughout history that changed entire cities and cultures, it was always the churches where people moved from consumer to committed. Churches that were full of people who do what Jesus says here, who denied themselves, who took up their cross, and who followed him. Jesus is still building his church, and he's building it with people like us who are committed to imperfect places, believing that God's dream will come to be in that church through their involvement. Let's pray. God, move that consumer mindset out of our hearts and minds. It doesn't just apply to church, it applies to so much else. It applies to relationships, it applies to so many things. But we pray that you'd get that out of our lives. You transform us through your Holy Spirit into the kinds of people who deny ourselves, who take up our cross and follow you. People who are ready, no matter what, to follow you through thick and thin, who, like Marilyn Johnson said, who stick with churches in the bad times and in the good times. Lord, we love you. Make us into the company of the committed. It's in your name we pray. Amen.
Thanks for listening. If that teaching moved you or left you with questions, let us know by sending a message to hello@bellevuechristian.church. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast for a new teaching from us every single week.